Buddhist Summer School, Tuesday afternoon, 30th August 1977. Here is the question. It's dated the 29th. You said this morning, after talking about the ill state, practice yoga, not just physical movements, hatha yoga. Practice the yoga. Will you please enlarge upon that? The answer is really quite simple. The practice of the asanas and pranayama, but the asanas particularly, the physical movements, is just one of the eight ingredients of yoga. It comes third in the list. If you look in the Shandilya Upanishad, where you find perhaps the earliest exposition in full of these eight aspects, you will find that they start with yama and niyama, the practice of the moralities and the religious observances, as they are called. In a way, they comprise what in Buddhism is presented as the sila, and the samma ajivo, right, perfect mode of living. You see, yama and niyama. And remember that these are approached in hatha yoga as the restraints upon oneself. And the Buddha uses the word restraint very constantly, very, very often. When those two have been sufficiently developed, this held, as far as I know, completely in the old days. Nowadays, people are a bit slack in India too, teaching yoga. They are more concerned with making a business out of it, rather than really teaching yoga. When the novice was proficient and had really developed the moralities and the religious observances, then they taught him the asanas. This is not just a keep fit system. It does keep you fit, but it is directed specifically so to train the body and to pay such attention to the benefit of the nervous system that the body realizes samatha, calmness. And it will not be an obstruction to meditation when you start meditating. You and I know from our own experience, when we sit down for meditation, all sorts of little itches start off, which weren't there before, rumblings in the tummy, and goodness knows what not happens, to obstruct the meditative process. But the fundamental purpose of the bodily discipline in terms of the asanas, you see, is so to train the body that it remains the perfect, sensitive, refined apparatus for the purpose of meditation. Another thing, it makes the body the right sort of apparatus to be the receptacle for the inflow of archetypal energies. You see? Then comes the other part, the pranayama. They call it the control of the breath, the restraint of the breath. But it is something which deals not merely with our biological breathing. It's not just a taking in and an expelling of the oxygen-nitrogen mixture together with all the other gases of the atmosphere and the pollution which man's activities or misactivities throws out into the atmosphere. You see? Pranayama. This pranayama, the control over the rhythm of the breath, fulfills various purposes for the release of various kinds of energy with safety for the organism and with safety for the psyche. There are many, many cases of derangement following upon pranayama. You must be very careful about that. Now, the asanas and pranayama, the exercises as we call them, you see, prepare the ground. If the ground isn't properly prepared, which itself has to be preceded, don't forget that, that is the indispensable part, by the moralities and the religious observances, then what follows, which is the real yoga, cannot be carried out. That real yoga then consists of the other four aspects. You have yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, and then pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, samadhi. Pratyahara is usually translated in, this is a somewhat misleading translation, of as the withdrawal of the senses from the objects of sense. Now this tends to give a distorted meaning to our brains. It is not the withdrawal of the senses from the objects of sense. It decidedly is not that. How can you withdraw the senses, the sense organs, from the objects of sense? How can you live at all if your sense organs are not functioning and fulfilling their proper purpose? You've got to see and hear and touch and taste and smell, etc., throughout your daily life. There's no question about that. But it means that the functioning of your senses will be free of the psychical reactions in terms of attachment and aversion. That's the fundamental meaning of pratyahara. What is withdrawn in the functioning of the senses in relation to the world in which you live, what is withdrawn is this psychical, this immature psychical reaction. I like, I want more, I shall have it, I dislike, I'll get rid of it, etc. You see, that is what pratyahara means. It is the same as putting away with right wisdom. It is the right practice of mindfulness. And in this right practice of mindfulness, which is the real pratyahara, the self-sense, the ego-sense, is at peace. That is what is withdrawn. Therefore, grasping is not present. See? That's why pratyahara is very, very important. And the training of the body and the breathing, which goes on in ordinary life perfectly rhythmically, if you are practicing yoga in the true sense, then enables you to be free of attachment and aversion more easily than if the psychophysical organism were unprepared for the task. And that is followed by dhyana, which means the entry into the deep states of consciousness. And the entry into the deep states of consciousness is associated with the perceiving and feeling, which is not the perceiving and feeling at our ordinary psychophysical level, but the entry of perception and feeling into the transcendental level. At the transcendental level, that perception and feeling in dhyana. And then in the final state, we have therefore in yoga the dharana after pratyahara, it goes on to dharana, which is the Sanskrit word derived from dhri, which means to uphold. You uphold the eternal order of the universe. You are a cooperator with the universal process. In terms of the flow of archetypal energies, dharana, dhyana, your attentiveness is there, and your attentiveness is also here simultaneously. So the here, the this, is put into perfect relationship with the what we commonly call the there. It is a real here-now attentiveness. Dharana, dhyana, and then the final samadhi, the supreme togetherness, the supreme at-one-ment, in which selfness is not. See, it's peculiarly akin to the Eightfold Path. It's akin to it. It's not identical by any means, but it is akin to it. So, when I said practice yoga, not just physical movements, that is what is meant. Then, you said, if we follow our proper function down here, we maintain the cosmic order. Well, I think, in a sense, that has been answered by answering the previous question. And then there are specific questions asked in connection with that. How do we draw on our cosmic energies? You don't have to draw upon them. They are constantly present. They are constantly present. But they are not operative upon us because there are various forces, various energies which act as protective powers preventing these cosmic energies from entering into us. You know, science knows that there are various radiations coming in from outer space. Unless there were protective layers around the Earth of various sorts which keep us safe from the impact of these radiations, we would be burnt to a cinder, so to say. This is a scientifically known fact. We are protected from their entry upon us as organisms. And similarly, there is this in the sphere of mind. So we don't have to draw upon them. As and when one's discipline has prepared one rightly, they will naturally and easily interplay because the channels are rightly open and the apparatus, the psychophysical organism, is a prepared apparatus. It's not like a bulb which is supposed to take a 240 volt current but receives a 540 volt. And of course you know what happens to the bulb. Now, what is our proper function down here? Self-discipline. That's our job. Also, in view of a statement you made today, that's yesterday, it's dated the 29th, it's not Irish, that one view of one's proper function was to have 6 children, etc. No, I think the context was one in which we were having a little fun at the expense of what some people think their function is, their proper function. The ill state you mentioned this morning, again this is yesterday, responsible for such situations as the wearing of black in Catholic countries, presumably since the death of Jesus Christ, the wall of lamentation in Jerusalem, the innate desire to kill, wars, hate, envy, etc. And the question is this unbearable state purely an outcome of our not being in communion? The questioner has written in community, but I presume what is meant is in communion. Yes. If we were in communion, all these things wouldn't take place. Now, the next questioner. As stated on the blackboard, the time of the setting sun is the most contemplative hour of the day. And yet one hears that noon and other times are auspicious for meditation. Would you explain if these times have deep significance? As much significance as the statement which was on the blackboard yesterday, the color of Ratnasambhava, the red of the setting sun. And the setting sun, is it there now? Oh, yes. The color of the setting sun. You know, if those of you who have been in India, you know that sunset, or I suppose this applies to all subtropical and tropical countries, there is something about that sunset hour which is quite extraordinary. It is the same here. It is the same here too. But our life is such that we are not awake to it. We are not sensitive enough to it. But you will find this peculiar hush come over everything as the twilight grows and deepens. It's as if all the birds are now praying, and all the trees are in communion, and the stars, as they come out and twinkle, have that extraordinary sensation of the peace, the deep peace, and this unperturbed, calm joy of the awakened sense of unity with everything.
I've heard it said in India that hour is the hour which the earth gives forth sattva.
Uh-huh. That I haven't heard myself. But at other times, the sunrise is the same sort of thing. Just before sunrise, particularly the dawn. The dawn and the sunset. And the noonday sun too. The point of changeover. When the sun is at the zenith, if you are attentive to it at that time, you will sense this. So don't lay too much stress on these things. Next question. If the experiencing of the jhanas, etc., does not lead to dispassion, etc., as the Buddha said, you see, not conduce to Nibbana, to what end and for what purpose were they taught by the Buddha? To give a complete answer would take a very long time. The short answer is this, that the ability to enter into the deep states of consciousness is part and parcel of the process of development, growth, and fruition of that religiousness within us. When that takes place, the human, the subhuman who is here and now has grown into the true human being. You will notice what importance the Buddha attaches to this, to the entry into the jhanas. If you look at the discourse, I think it's number 30, or look at both discourses, numbers 29 and 30. They are the greater and the lesser discourse on the simile of the pith. You see? On the simile of the pith, to get at the pith of everything. And if curiously enough, it's in the lesser discourse, that's supposed to be shorter one, where the Buddha takes where he stopped in the greater one, takes it to its conclusion. And he says, and what are those things which are more excellent and perfect than this, that, or the other state, you see? And then he just gives you the recital of the jhanas and the samapattis, till you come to the ultimate point, the cessation of perception and feeling. And then the bhikkhu knows that the great purpose of the Brahma faring, the great objective of the Brahma faring, is the realization of unshakable freedom of mind. You see? So if the Buddha attached so much importance to the jhanas and samapattis as such, there must have been something very wonderful about them in themselves, in their own rights. How should a learner meditator regard the jhanas? Just in that way. Should he deliberately develop them along with the rest of the religious life? They will naturally, one naturally enters into the jhanas, provided the right sort of discipline has been gone through, provided you are able to be quiet and let the pacification of the sense functions and the discursive thought process take place. When the discursive thought process really calms down completely, then it stops. You see? It stops. All the process of reaction from the brain to every sense impression or event or situation or whatever, it just stops. There is no reaction. There is just a state of pure observation, and mind in its reality begins to manifest more and more strongly. And the intensification of that step by step is described as the first, second, third, fourth jhanas. We'll talk about that tomorrow is Wednesday. Oh. We'll talk about it sometime before we finish. Now, should one develop them deliberately or regard them as fortuitous happenings when they occur? Sometimes they will just happen on their own. You know, that's what happened to Siddhartha Gautama himself when he was at home before he went forth. One day he sat down under a rose apple tree, and it just happened that he had this mystical experience. Many, many thousands of people have had this kind of mystical experience. Akbar, the great Mughal, was one who used to have such mystical experiences. Do you know, he used to eat only one meal a day, and he was a very powerfully built man. When the people of Malwa, nearly 900 miles away from the capital, in the heat of midsummer, rebelled against him, he took his army and marched down in 11 days, 900 miles. You try and walk 900 miles in the heat of the day, and he had to traverse desert soil too, and completely surprised the other folk. So they invited him to dinner and patched it up. I ask these questions because I have never quite thrown off the desire to experience higher states of consciousness. The desire will act obstructively. Then the questioner goes on, because, one, they lead to growing understanding. That is true, they do. understanding in the inner deep sense, are pleasurable, beware, attachment, grasping, that will stop proper jhana, but they are pleasurable in fact, because the Buddha himself says with respect to that very first experience of his, that this was pure happiness. It came upon him. And do remember, whatsoever comes to you from the infinite through grace is something that is utterly pure, utterly wonderful. Don't besmirch it by afterwards desiring to repeat it, to have more of it. But the entry into the profound states is sheer happiness. And the Buddha himself says that the supreme happiness is in the ultimate state beyond the fourth samadhi, samapatti, the ceasing of perception and feeling. That's the ultimate happiness. He himself says that. And C, have some intrinsic value in their own right. Well, I have touched upon that. Could you please say whether or not we may converse quietly for 15 minutes at tea, as there appears to be some uncertainty? Oh, I think Carolyn settled that point in announcing what should be done.
Not at the silent tables, that's all.
You have the answer. Or should we remain silent anyway, in case someone is present who is expecting the table to be silent? Well, the table is always silent. A case of the supreme unconscious wisdom. Surely there were more questions. No, there aren't. So, there we are.
Could you tell me, dearest, please, when the Buddha said, you know, when he sat under a rose tree and accidentally, when the Buddha found himself going into a jhana, the one that was pure happiness?
Yes.
Can you tell me where I find that, please?
It's in one of the suttas in the Majjhima. It's not in the Digha. I think it's in volume 1. It is in volume 1. I'll give you the page number. It's on page 301. The Pali reference is M1 246. That's in the Pali text.
Yes.
In the translation, that is Miss Horner's translation. This is what he says. Aggivesana is the person who is talking with him. This Aggivesana occurred to me. I know that while my father was ploughing and I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree, aloof from pleasures of the senses, aloof from unskilled states of mind, entering on the first jhana, which is accompanied by initial thought and discursive thought, is born of aloofness and is rapturous and joyful. And while abiding therein, I thought, now, could this be a way to awakening? Yes. Then, following on my mindfulness, there was the consciousness. This is itself the way to awakening. This occurred to me then. Now, am I afraid of that happiness, which is happiness apart from sense pleasures, apart from unskilled states of mind? Then this occurred to me. I am not afraid of that happiness, which is happiness apart from sense pleasures, apart from unskilled states of mind. And he goes on to say to Aggivesana, who perhaps believed in mortifying the flesh, now it is not easy to reach that happiness by subjecting the body to extreme emaciation. And there is another context, I have forgotten where that is. He does declare, it's somewhere in the earlier part of the Majjhima, step by step, he takes you on to the ultimate cessation and says, this is the supreme happiness. Do remember, please, I'm not an encyclopedia.